Welcome to the You Catastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. I'm Joel Harrison, joined as always by Dave Taylor here. And gosh, there's a number of things I'd just love to open with. I felt after all the Marvel films, after Avengers Endgame, that maybe life was over in some respects, but there's just other things that just the world keeps giving us. So we've had The Mandalorian. We've had the Wonder Woman trailer. Yeah. Black Widow trailer. And then just before we went to recording, I got to watch Dave play a Star Wars game in which a giant spider killed him 3 times.
It was so frustrating.
This is in preparation for our 9 days. Is it 9 days?
I think it's 8 days now.
8 days. 8 days until Rise of Skywalker. Wow.
So this is where in 8 days' time, I'll be in a Broadway cinema with Joel as he kind of nervously frets about whether or not people will be speaking or eating food near him.
Oh my gosh.
During the screen.
Oh my gosh. I can't think of anything worse. I don't want to hear chewing. Just get out of my theater. So we are doing our potentially final episode. We're not sure. We may do one quickly as a sort of, you know, our thoughts after Rise of Skywalker. But this is more or less our final for this year, which means we've done actually 30 episodes.
Yay.
This year, which seems quite remarkable that we actually managed to coordinate in order to do 30 episodes. So what was your favorite moment?
I think the moments where I wasn't being accused of misogyny.
I was going to say that was my favorite moment. When you got to share your views with the world.
I think I referred to a certain segment of the evangelical church as masturbatory.
Okay. Yeah. We did talk about us as an illicit pleasure.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
What was your favorite episode?
I really like talking about the disability stuff because it was a good kind of dump of a lot of the stuff that's going through my mind. But to be honest, I probably either talking about Avengers Endgame or Joker.
Oh, Joker. Oh,
I actually really enjoyed that episode.
Yeah, yeah. I'd probably say talking about Fleabag as well.
Oh, that's true. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, anyway, tell us what your favorite one was, maybe, dear listener.
Yeah.
Send us your thoughts. Maybe we should do, I don't know, if we do a monkey survey or what are they called? Monkey, what are, survey monkey. Get the right one.
Monkey survey. Yeah. What's your favorite
We're
monkey?
Calling them, our listeners are not monkeys. Yeah. We're not, maybe we will. I don't know. Or you could just send us a message.
Yeah.
Anyway, what are we actually doing for our final hurrah of 2019?
One of the consistent bits of feedback that we've got is that people want to know a bit more about us. Mm. You and I, Joel. Who would have thought the people with the two most irritating voices in podcasting probably? And so I thought I'd do a little exercise with you. As people might know, I'm a therapist in training, I've picked up this little activity called the Conversation Toolkit. And it is a series of 100 questions that Sarah and I have started
using. I wasn't aware I needed a toolkit for
Other people are. So Sarah and I have started doing like intentional dinner parties where we're having people around to have conversations. It's kind of trying to get back to a lot of our roots where we used to have like focused discussion nights around the table or poetry reading nights and things like that. But one of the things we're doing at the moment is using this resource, which is from School of Life, as an organization I get a lot out of. And they're an organization that promotes kind of cultural analysis or drawing on culture in order to develop yourself, psychotherapy and philosophy and things like that. And they've got this set of 100 questions. So all we're going to do is we're going to pick a question out of a group of three that we would like to answer, and we're going to have a chat about those things. So all you're going to be hearing for this episode is us responding to questions that Joel hasn't seen yet.
Yeah, I find this is always a bit of a ask for me. It's almost too confessional.
Yeah. That's what the audience wants, and that's what they get.
They may discover that you go to the bathroom and eat flowers.
They already knew that.
Who's going first?
Do you have one in front of you? You want to answer?
Sure. So my three questions that I have picked here, and I haven't picked them, I've just picked them up. One is, in what ways are you prone to addiction? Oh, God, that's hardcore. Have you ever had a recurring dream? Is there an art to loading the dishwasher? Oh, I'm taking the last one.
Yeah, sure.
Is there an art to loading the dishwasher? Absolutely. Like, it's not just an art, it's a regimented form.
Yeah.
There is a right order to ordering the dishwasher.
And that's kind of reflective of your personality a little bit, isn't it, Joel?
What? What? There's an objective truth that people must cohere to it?
Sarah and I used to live in a share house with another family, and it was a quasi-intentional community. And one of the big struggles was competing values around dishwashers.
I don't see how there could be. It's not like there's incommensurable ways to load a dishwasher here. There is just a way to do it.
Yeah.
You have to maximize the bowls in a particular order. She probably already knows this, but when Kate loads a dishwasher, I then go and rage it every single time.
So Sarah, my wife Sarah is filling in as producer this evening, and she's sitting across from me nodding ferociously.
Well, you need to sort yourself out.
Yeah. So my questions in this set, what are the best features of middle age?
we're almost there.
What work were you doing the last time you forgot time altogether? If you knew you only had 1 year to live from now, how would you spend the next 12 months? I think I'll go for the what work were you doing last time you forgot time altogether. I find it really hard to get into that state because I was doing in undergraduate, I was doing a course called The Philosophy of Happiness. And one of the ways in which people have described ideal happiness or ideal kind of subjective well-being is in this what they call flow state, where you kind of forget yourself and get churned out. But there has been times where I've been doing really boring data entry stuff at my work that has been quite, I got in the zone over.
But that seems just more methodical. Like it's just you get into a zone because it's just entry. No, the clock sort of just ticks over. Or were you actually saying
I lost time. But there was also times where I was painting our apartments in our last share house where that happened. But there's time if I'm in, I think the highest kind of joy for me as far as work goes where I get in these states is if I have gotten to the heart of an argument that I'm trying to make in an essay, then I can find myself losing hours and hours without noticing it. So I suppose that would be it would be some sort of philosophy essay or something like that where it just all comes together.
Yeah, the question wasn't work for you, but when do you get lost in a game? And then it could be when you're perpetually dying to a spider again and again and again time just seems to be a recurring loop. You know, that would have made sense as well.
I don't lose myself at those times. it would be more like you'd be your Rome Total Wars is where I'd lose days without realizing it.
Where does your model of a normal home life come from? Do you feel happier spending or saving? What's the best evening you've ever had? Wow.
Things are about to get
conversation
a blue.
Starting as well. I don't know. This is a bit rough. Where does your model of a normal home life come from? Look, I like to say the Holy Family. Yeah.
So unwed mother.
Yeah. Older. Yep. Older gentleman who drops out of the scene pretty quick smart. and then I grew up and really just started my ministry at age 30. So where does my model of a normal home life come from? My own. I mean, I come from parents that are a good sort.
Yeah.
My brothers, I have four brothers. We all love each other. That's good.
Mm.
I'm sure we infuriate each other too, but that's all good. And my home growing up was always very like a hostel.
Hostile?
Hostile.
All right.
It wasn't hostile, as in people were always coming through it.
Yeah,
and
right.
always welcome into it. So I always have a sense of like when we do Christmas in Australia, it's a bit quieter. It's almost too quiet for me.
Mm.
Whereas I like the kind of, you know, it's big family and so on. And then you go straight into, and then you basically, because it's big family, you can have your sort of moments of regeneration by yourself because nobody cares.
Yeah.
So it's actually a difference I noticed between my family and Kate's when I first started hanging out with Kate's family.
Yeah.
Is that if I said, oh, I'm just going to go off and read a book or I'm going to go lie down by myself, everyone was like, is it okay? And it's a super intensity. You know, like, and I went, whoa, whereas in my family, no one would care because there's multiple other people. And so you're kind of, you're not as big a deal, right? Yep. When you're number four or five, as I am, you just have to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, lad. There you go.
I mean, that is absolutely true, having a small family. Yep.
The intensity
is different. No one can hide. It is intense. So my questions are, what makes you envious? Would you prefer a view of a desert or of the sea, and why? And if you were in charge of the Bill Gates Foundation but could only spend the funds tackling one issue, what would it be?
Dismantling the Bill Gates Foundation. No, like seriously, they make their money out of like Coca-Cola and stuff. But anyway.
Yeah. I suppose I'll pick this question. That's a reasonable point in that, yeah, how is capitalism an issue? Is sure. a single issue?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Bill Gates owns most of it, so.
Yeah. I mean, this is really tricky. One issue, because I suppose you have to say climate change, right? What would you say?
My one issue?
If you had all the money available to Bill Gates Foundation.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that enough to make a meaningful
One issue? One issue? Your heart.
My heart in particular? Yeah, or yours. The heart of the listener?
No, your heart.
I'd probably just put it into promotion for the podcast. No, yeah. I don't know. It's like there's all sorts of stuff.
There's something legit in what you're saying, you know, about capitalism. The fact that Bill Gates has a foundation, you know, and where does that money come from?
Yeah.
And Bill Gates he's a multi-billionaire, and he said that comment earlier this year where they were talking about the billionaire tax. And he said, you know, if my billions reduce from 50 billion to 40 billion, I might not care so much. But if you get me to 20 billion, oh, I'm going to be looking at my bank balance. And you're going, this guy's just off the planet.
Yeah. I mean, that's partially true. Maybe like having a foundation devoted to closing kind of tax havens and things like that, making sure people are invested in their political community through taxation.
Mm.
That's probably a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Maybe I could say that.
Yeah.
Because that in turn would go a long way to solving some climate change issues.
Okay, here's mine. Do you have a technique for keeping calm? I can answer that straight away. No, I am the Incredible Hulk in Avengers 1. The trick is, Captain, I'm always angry. Okay. But I'll keep going. What would be the first thing you would do if you won the lottery? When do you feel shy? Well, I don't really feel shy. So. when do you feel? What would be the first thing you would do if you won the lottery? Feel incredibly guilty.
Why? Because you gambled?
Yep. Because I participated in gambling.
Right.
And I think gambling is an absolute pox upon, especially as I learned more recently in this country. So if I won the lottery,
Is the lottery something that problem gamblers engage in?
Totally.
I don't know.
Why not? Like buying your lotto tickets every week.
Yeah. Is that something people in Australia do? I don't even think about these things.
No, but I don't go to pokey machines either. So
I mean, pokey machines I know are a huge
problem. Yeah, but I'm sure the lottery also support, you know, they have to give out X money to charitable foundations and clubs and whatever.
Yeah.
But it's still then immiserating people.
Yeah, right.
Right, I imagine. And then, you know, so then I'd be faced with guilt and the immediate dilemma.
Mm.
the immediate dilemma. This sounds so virtuous, doesn't it? The immediate dilemma of, well, this isn't a virtuous. The immediate dilemma of, do I contribute money back to causes against gambling? So yeah. I use the money itself, or do I go, you know what, Sydney house market, blah, 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 all that, you know, get myself on the rungs. Mm. Yeah, so the first thing I'd do if I won the lottery would be, honestly, I'd feel guilty. But then I have a, this is a curious thing about me, because I sound very assertive and bordering on aggressive at times, of course. but I find it incredibly hard to buy things.
Right.
Like, if you put in front of me a bunch of shirts and said, Joel, you got to buy a shirt, I find that incredibly difficult.
What was the last
difficult.
Package that arrived at your house?
It was a Superman.
Right. Just checking.
But that was beautiful.
Yeah. So, what, about 50 centimeters tall?
Yeah, it's probably the size of your daredevil. Yeah, I find it incredibly hard to buy things. So if I won the lottery and I actually came into a lot of money, I probably would have no idea. I'd face the paralysis of choice, probably, as well as guilt. There you go.
Okay. My questions are, who's the best boss you've ever had? Have you ever sabotaged your own success?
Why is Sarah laughing?
I don't know.
I don't know.
She's out of control.
She's just, she's one glass of wine in.
In what ways might you be a difficult person to work with or for?
Wow.
Have you ever sabotaged your own success? I'll answer this. Have I ever sabotaged my own success? Yes, all the time. I have so many problems in this arena. This might be very strange for you to hear listening to me on a podcast, but I have a very hard time in believing that anyone ever wants to listen to what I have to say. And so even when people come up to me and say, why do you think Christianity is true or something like that, I'll then start going into a very deep kind of philosophical account or something like that, and be constantly apologizing to them for speaking. So that's one of the biggest ways I sabotage myself. I assume that, and I think it's part of it is a class background thing. I probably subconsciously think that kind of intellectual pursuits are worthless or something like that. Or I feel embarrassed about pursuing or being interested in cultural or intellectual things. And so, yeah, I think, if anyone here is listening has had a conversation with me, they probably know this.
You also have like the alternative to just world hypothesis.
Yeah.
Like you have an unjust world. for yourself. Like you think that unjust things, like so you think things are going to be not unjust, you think you don't deserve things.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I tend to think that if I've achieved anything, it's because I've duped the system somehow.
Well, that may be true, but sometimes you gotta do some duping.
Yeah, I think that's probably the way I sabotage. Do you self-sabotage? No.
I'm sure I do.
Being obnoxious to people when you're
probably. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think people with me fall into two camps, right? Like me or think I'm just the worst.
What did our friend Victor's wife say to you when she first met you?
I was holding a child and I started saying something about my wife wants one of you. And I was talking to the kid and then she grabbed their kid back and then said something like, well, he's a strange man. And I was like, well, tell him early, eh? Okay, why do you have the ambitions you have? Why do you have the ambitions you have? Or under what conditions could you have an open relationship and make it work? I couldn't is the answer to that. Can adultery ever be acceptable? Oh, well, I'm not going to do that one either. Okay, so let's do the why do you have the ambitions you have? I mean, you could kind of go all family systems on this and say I'm the fourth son of five boys, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I tried to just basically achieve in that context. Not I wasn't ultra competitive with my brothers. It was more just getting out and doing your own thing.
But your ambitions are quite niche though. So I don't think your ambitions are just about being a high achiever. You're trying to achieve in a very, very specific arena of the world, which is like the intersection of theology and law. So why those ambitions?
Well, that's just the combination of, and I hope, like an intellectual curiosity and trying to say something true.
Yeah.
Right?
So getting back to the dishwasher.
Yeah, probably.
But on a cosmic and constitutional level.
That's right. Like seeking right order so that we can engage in right relationships.
Yeah.
But also there's probably a personal element there, right, as well. Like the intellectual inquiry that is public is also into yourself, right? Like, so it's also an element of like trying to figure out what you think is also an exploration into the depths of sort of your own ways of thinking or what makes you tick. Yeah. I also have a kind of like civic element to it, I think. Why do you have the ambitions you have? So I work at sort of the intersection of church and state, right? And there's an element there of trying to actually be of use. Anyway, here you go. Your turn.
Okay. I seem to have only... Oh, dear. I got the question, which is, what would your ideal pornography be like?
Oh, oh, that's so nice.
Do you have a relationship
pattern? Would it be fully clothed?
Yes. Two people sitting fully clothed, very chastely, discussing why they shouldn't be commodified.
And then over a 20-year course, developing a relationship.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Do you have a relationship pattern? If so, has it tended to lead to a suitable or unsuitable partners? Well, my relationship pattern is being married for 16 years.
Yeah. Got married at 12.
So if you had to choose between a happy home life and a mediocre career, or a successful career and a mediocre home life, I want you to answer this one. Which would you choose? So for me, it's undoubtedly having a happy home life. Oh, my goodness. Someone just screamed outside our house. So the question is, choice between a happy home life and a mediocre career, or vice versa. So I think I'd definitely choose happy home life, because I genuinely believe that there is very meaningful things that you can do with one's life that aren't vocational or to do with a career. So, you know, if I got to be happy at home and could read some books and things like that and have good conversations with people, I think I'd be more than happy. How would you answer this question?
Why do you think I'd answer it differently?
I don't know.
Man.
Because you're a bit more ambitious than I am.
Yeah, but like I'd still have an element of if I died and Ambrose hated me because I was just, you know, some workaholic. That's a real problem. But no, I don't think we'd ever do this, but I've said to Kate, you know, if she ever went super ambitious and as long as she gave me a good internet connection so I could read stuff and then like you have a, you know, good reading life and whatever. But I think those sort of dichotomies are a bit ridiculous. You know, like the happy home life is about, for us, we've always conceived of it as, you know, a mutual partnership in which you try and help each other flourish in the same, you know, in things that we share in common. And that means externally in work life and so on. So I could never dichotomize it like that. But yeah, if you had to say like, your work or your child. Anyway, would you like to live more in your body or more in your head? Well, you heard us last week talking about our summer bods. I'm not doing that one. Is it better to give money to the government or to charity? What are the best things you owe your parents? Oh, I don't want to do the money to government or charity as well. It's another one of those dichotomy silly things. What are the best things you owe your parents? A grandma.
A grandma?
Yeah.
A grandpa.
Grandma.
All right.
not my grandmother. A grandma.
Right.
Of a tradition, of a way of talking.
Yeah.
Bless
your real name.
In my Gene. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Even I picked up some of your family's grandma.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So apparently when Joel's dad gets cut off, the only thing he'll exclaim is something like, oh, bless you real neat.
Yeah, yeah. If someone cuts him off in traffic, you'll go, bless him, Lord. Bless him real good. And then, no. If he's complimenting, he's like, you know, if he's saying something nice to you, it's like, oh, Dave, bless you. Bless you real neat. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. But he also says other wild things. But in my acknowledgements for my book, I have, you know, my parents first teaching me the language of divine love. Right. So, I mean, my dad is a minister. And he would sit down with all of us and we would go through texts and we would discuss them. And my parents also, so I come from a Pentecostal background where we've talked about this before. Within that tradition, there is, I think, deep veins of anti-intellectualism, right? Mm. But my parents were never really that. So it was a strange position to be in because they were all in favor of us doing well, school education and thinking and so on. And my dad was a former teacher and had done his own study. And so they gave me that sense as well of like actual joyful inquiry.
Hmm.
There you go.
My questions are, in what areas are you happy to be good enough? That is good enough.
Why is Sarah laughing?
That's unbelievable. Would you be happy to tell your friends how much you earn? In what ways have your parents influenced your choice as a partner? Jeez. I'll do this.
What was the last one?
In what ways have your parents influenced your choices, your choice of or choices of partner?
Uh-huh.
So I'll do the tell your friends how much you earn. Would you be happy to tell your friends how much you earn? I think this is a really interesting question because we were talking about this before a bit, that Harris admonished some business students, I think, or some students in general.
That's right. Yeah, as business students.
To keep each other accountable about how much money that they make.
Yeah.
As part of their discipleship. That's really interesting. I think I'd be relatively happy. I'd be a bit embarrassed because I make very little money at the moment. But I don't think I'd be too embarrassed. And most of the people I count as friends wouldn't really care about that. Would you care that I, although you'd be a bit indignant.
Oh, I get indignant for you, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I think I would be. Would you be happy to tell, although we talk, yeah.
Mine's public. Mine's already public. You could go on Sydney University website and find out. It's not hard to see. And yeah, I think. I did find this actually going through law school. And then when we all graduated, we'd all talk about our salaries as not like, oh, look at mine, it's so great. It was just everyone talked about, you know, oh, this is what I'm doing. And then after about, you know, a few years, people start differentiating because some of them were going further and then no more conversations about one's pay packet and these sorts of things. So it basically is it's more a wealthy person thing, right, not to talk about such things, obviously.
Is it?
You could say there'd be embarrassment or shame, but for the wealthy, it's like competitive.
Yeah, right. Okay.
If you had married your first boy/girlfriend, what might your life be like now? What plausible government action would make you leave the country? Growing up, who was the favorite in your family? Well, I'll just answer that quickly. My brothers and I say if we all put on a firing range, and my mother said you can have one, we all know that we would turn to each other and say, it's been nice knowing you, Jeremy, good luck with your life, which is my oldest brother. But I'll answer the one about what plausible government action would make you leave the country. This I'm going to answer a little differently because the plausible government action in this country is they kick out all the New Zealanders, which is something this government is already doing if you are subject to an offence sentence that then they consider diminishes your character, good character to be in Australia. So there are people who have grown up their entire lives in Australia, been here since they were babies, and now they're shipped off to New Zealand where they're told to just get on with their life. They know absolutely no one, don't have family there, don't have friends, don't have support and so on. And so it's actually quite a real dilemma. And the New Zealand government has tried to push the Australians on it a number of times, but anyway, so that would be the actual plausible thing that would make me leave the country.
Are we the baddies?
If I answered it in the kind of way it means, what plausible government action would make you leave the country? Probably an unjust war in which they, you know, start conscripting us all. Maybe.
It's a tricky one.
Because it assumes as well that the government doing an action that you disagree with means that you leave. Whereas we were talking about this earlier, how on Twitter you sometimes get this trending,
not my prime minister.
Yeah. You know, Scott Morrison, not my prime minister. And I'm like, I don't agree with what he's doing as well. But if I'm an Australian, he's my prime minister.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, because I have then the civic obligation to contest that.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right.
If I just if I do this bourgeois cosmopolitan strategy, that's a real problem.
Yeah, I remember there was a great episode of The Mindfield with Australian philosopher Raymond Gaita was on it. And he's someone that has written a lot about learning to, as a modern person, learning to find roots and in a particular geographic location. A particular problem, I think, for a lot of people in colonial states and things like that. How do we relate to the land that we live in? And he was complaining about after the upset election where ScoMo won, or the Liberal Party won, and a lot of his kind of bourgeois friends were all going, well, let's all move to New Zealand. And he was saying, like, well, bloody go then. Mm. If that's the level of your solidarity with your fellow country people and your commitment to your political system, bloody good luck to you. I really appreciate that perspective. And it is such a bourgeois cosmopolitanism perspective. I've got the liquid assets sufficient that I can go anywhere and I'm not dependent. When you compare that to the plight of like asylum seekers who have no place, guaranteed place in the world, it's just disgusting.
Or just people who can't move. But anyway, you go on to your question.
Okay, maybe one more each.
Who started?
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Who's your biggest fan? Would you prefer to be a singleton or smug married?
We come full circle.
If you read your parents' emails, what do you fear you might discover that would upset you? That's a difficult one for me. Would you prefer to be a singleton or smug married? I don't think I could be single because I've been married since I was 20 and we've been married for 16 years. This Friday's our anniversary.
Last Friday. You posted online.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Gosh.
my Facebook friends. we did. We were after dinner. 60 married, and I don't know how not to be in.
But you're smug married.
Yeah, sure.
So that's kind of like how you and Sarah go for running around the lake. Yeah,
or go kayaking together.
Oh, we just saw a bird.
Let's
identify it by its wingspan.
Or even we make physical contact together in your presence.
Yeah, you guys
which makes you.
You guys are massive PDA.
Dry heave.
You're massive PDA. All right, what are your happiest memories of your parents? If you had to write a book, what would it be about? No, thank you. Can incompatibility ever be a strength in a relationship? What does that mean? Does that mean you're fundamentally incompatible? Does it mean like you disagree on things?
I imagine that's what it means. Because if it's incompatible, meaning that it's an irreconcilable difference, then you don't have a relationship. So,
okay, well, I'll take that then.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Give examples.
Look, I mean, I think I, unlike you, I didn't get married at 12. Mm. We were 31. And it meant actually having to change. So we'd both lived our own lives for quite a bit. I used to be a real night person, as in I could go to bed quite late.
Yep.
And then I'd get up very late. And I could work through that time and stuff. Maybe I just got older and it doesn't work as well. Mm. But clearly Kate, she doesn't do that sort of thing. And so there was a kind of the actual fact that there's another person embodied there that stops you from just doing your own thing, right? And that actually, that takes a bit of getting used to, although I think it's much gotten used to.
She has these beliefs that you should go for a run and you have a belief that you shouldn't.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. She really does. What else? So incompatibility. I don't know. I mean, I don't. It's a funny paradigm to think about, right? Like, because it's always got a dialectical element to it. So we're in disagreement, and that's going to strengthen us. I don't know. I think of our relationship as again like partnership, and we're both pointing towards the same ends. We may have disagreements on that.
Mm.
So I think I've just answered that question very poorly. Just don't really quite get what, anyway.
Do you want a bonus one?
Yeah, bonus one. That was a crappy one to finish on.
Oh.
What music has influenced your attitude to life? Hmm. Church music.
shine Jesus, shine.
The only massive influence would it's probably the same as you. It's probably like Pearl Jam. You've probably got multiple things, don't you?
I've got a lot going on. Yeah.
Music, yeah. I mean, like different phases. What do I listen to now? Honestly, I don't get to listen to much music. At the moment, it's like whatever Ambrose wants on the radio station.
Yeah, you're not really someone that kind of craves music.
No, yeah, I do like it.
But I
don't like some music. Like you like that guy who just made me listen to, just growled at us.
Tom Waits.
That wasn't cool.
Yeah, but for me, it'd be like one of the biggest musical moments of my life was Sarah and I went to see a performance of Arvo Pärt's music. Arvo Pärt's an Estonian composer of sacred music, like minimalist sacred music. And it was the first time I'd felt like what I imagine people who are into worship music, contemporary worship music, feel when they're getting off on worship. Mm. What do they say in like the Celtic Christian tradition of like the thin space where the gap between heaven and earth is particularly thin in this space and moment. There was a particular piece of music where it was just a few notes on a piano and some very minimal chords being played on a violin, just gently and gently and building. And there was this moment in the concert where all of a sudden there was a projector and it had snow falling on the projector. And then all of a sudden somehow the snow started falling off the screen. Mm. And it was this beautiful depiction of just the grace of God flowing down. And I think that set me on a path towards a more mystical, a more traditional, more liturgical life in the church. This is probably in my mid-20s.
Yeah,
so that'll be my moment.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so if we do a bit more of that, yeah.
Oh, you want to sound cooler than Pearl Jam?
No, yeah. But I was saying before, like even like Litany of the Saints and things like this, They're just, you know, things that actually fit into liturgical worship and they're just, and somebody's singing for you. The idea there as well. That
the Gloria for Sarah is singing the Gloria around the house more than we'd probably like to.
But sometimes that you don't have to be singing it yourself, right? Mm. Like that somebody else could be actually singing, you could be swept up in that. Whereas when I grew up in the Pentecostal context, it was all about trying to get your own sort of, you had to, and the fact that I was a rubbish singer was really a problem. So I used to, as a kid, I thought I was a good singer because they let me sing at church. And then I went to primary school and tried out for the choir three times. And then they let me into the choir on the third time so that I could be the one who introduced the choir. but like, you know, I wasn't a good singer. So in the Pentecostal, whereas then getting into a context where, you're actually swept away by other people singing as well, I think is quite a gift that other people can give to you. We should finish.
Yes.
We've been going well. But what we want to say is we want to thank a couple of people.
Yes.
We first of all want to thank Liam.
Yep.
Who has been producing these episodes for us throughout the year.
Yeah. We have an astounding level of quality for the
and that's the, unsurprising.
The level of organization that we have.
Any errors are our own because we don't know how to use microphones at times.
Yeah.
But Liam basically makes our podcast actually listenable.
Yeah.
So we're incredibly grateful to him for that. And he also sits there and listens to us and gives us his wry smiles. we're thankful to Tim Causbrook as well. Tim has helped us on occasions with some of our social media, as well as helping us with recordings at different times, and also just being a good fan and a person to bounce our ideas off with.
Yeah, and I suppose we also want to thank a lot of our followers on social media who have been engaging with us and helping us get it out there.
Yep.
There's probably too many to name there. But yeah, thank you so much for everyone who has contributed to that, making our little strange experiment kind of start to work a bit. Yeah, so thanks to all that.
And we may have another episode with Star Wars, but we'll just have to see how we go. Otherwise, the idea is to take a bit of a break for probably into February.
Yep.
And then think about what we're doing. So
with our lives generally.
Yeah, yeah. So if you have some thoughts and you want to give us some feedback on things you think work, don't work, whatever you want to say, or just even you want to drop us a line and say, hey, Dave, you do deserve that success. You're more than welcome to do so.
And thanks, Sarah, for recording for us tonight.
Yeah.
She's also been shuffling the question cards for us. Very
planting them.
please do, if you, gosh, if this is the first episode that you're listening to, it is not usually like this. We haven't mentioned Rowan Williams, Harrowers.
You did, actually.
Did we? Oh, we did too.
Did.
Anyway. It's very different to this. We usually follow us on Facebook. Just search for us, The Ucatastrophe. Find us on Twitter at UCAT, EUCAT underscore podcast on Twitter. And please share us around, like us, and tell your friends about us. We'll see you either after the Rise of Skywalker or next year. Bye.